next case, please? Just a minute, please.
Thank you. If it pleases the court, my name is David Schneer. I rise on behalf of the American Physician Institute and the Honorable Robert Marshall. I'd like to reserve about 5 minutes for my rebuttal. This case rises from the Freedom of Information Act. The university would like you to write them out of the act, even though the legislature expressly wrote them into it. Under their interpretation, the exception swallows the rule. In this case, the exception is the research data exception. The question before you today, one of three, is as to the nature of the term of a proprietary interest. What is the university's proprietary interest in data, records, and information that is the fruit of their research investigation? We think Walker v. Ohio State University describes it perfectly. Quote, the university explained that if the proprietary research data were disclosed publicly, Professor Napier and the university could suffer substantial harm, including loss of grants. And it is the protection of that which the exemption is intended and for which the legislature intended. However, once that research is published, then all of the data should become available so that people can validate the research, replicate it, or duplicate it. The challenge in this case is that we have offered you 22 specific emails to represent 13,000, and not a single one of them meets all 7 requirements of the research data exemption. The specific problem we see is that most of them, in fact, indeed all of them, have been publicly released. They were publicly released, the university gave them to Dr. Mann when he was not a citizen of Virginia, did not request them under was not an employee of the university, was an academic competitor in the marketplace of ideas, and was an economic competitor for grants. He was adverse to the University of Virginia at law because he had asked that they release no records whatever, and that these records were not even public records. So he could have no common interest.
Can I ask you a couple of sort of introductory questions that might help us set the stage here? You just talked about the documents and the proprietary clause there. That particular clause also says that it doesn't apply if the writings are copyrighted. Consequently, you would get them. You get them all because they were copyrighted, if they were. My review of this record, and there may be an answer to this question, I just want to give you the opportunity, but my review of this record is that you said they were copyrighted, the University of Virginia said they were copyrighted, Dr. Mann said they were copyrighted, and after having all of the parties in this case agree that they were copyrighted, the trial judge said they weren't, which is strange to me. I don't understand it, and I don't understand why your position wouldn't be everybody's agreed they're copyrighted, consequently, they are subject to disclosure. Let's start there.
I don't believe anyone has said that all of them are copyrighted. Indeed, none of the 22 has been copyrighted. They are subject to copyright. But the appropriate analysis of this is that the exclusion deals exclusively with data, research, and information coming out of the research. And in FICE publications v. Rural Telephone, it specifically states, as is clear in the copyright statute, that the most fundamental axiom of copyright law is that no author may copyright his ideas or the facts he narrates. So copyright has no place in this case at all. Although,
well, I mean, if the statute says it has a place in a case, why doesn't it?
It has a place to say to invalidate or to waive the exception. That's its purpose.
Right. Why doesn't it?
Why doesn't it waive it?
I mean, that's in your favor. Why doesn't it?
Well, I would argue, and I think it's important to argue, that the copyright law only deals with creative work, and this exception deals only with data. And I can't be an honest attorney and say that they are the same thing in Cocantony. The reality is, however, that the university has argued all of them are subject to copyright because all of them are and contain information or creative content. Here's the problem. The exception on which they rely does not protect emails. It only protects the data and the records that may be in an email. And so what we're looking at here is, and the question that you have approved for review
you
is...
You know, that just sounds so silly to me. That's like saying that I have a book here, mm-hmm. and the copyright doesn't protect the pages, it just protects the words. Is that what you mean?
Well, an example of this is County of Suffolk versus First American Real Estate. Here, a county had created a bunch of maps, and they had colored the maps. And someone wanted them under FOIA so that they could reproduce and sell them. And the county said, we don't want to release them because they're copyrighted. And the court said, no, the facts in them, the names of the streets and where they are not subject to copyright. And then went on to say that it's possible for Suffolk County to comply with its obligations under the Freedom of Information Law while preserving its rights under the Copyright Act. So you can do both. I just don't think it's an issue here. I appreciate that you would like us to be able to say, I'm sorry, they're all gone because they're subject to copyright.
Well, what you need to understand is that you have one case in front of this court.
Right.
And we see this as thousands of cases. So we want to know what that means.
To the degree that something is subject to copyright, it receives the same protections as if it were copyrighted. To that end, if it is subject to copyright, arguably, one could say that because it is subject to copyright and because the Virginia Code 37054 says where data records has been publicly released, published, copyrighted, or patented, it would waive the requirement. However, and this is my concern, I'm standing here saying the university wants you to have an exception that swallows the rule. That, too, would swallow the rule. I hesitate to make the argument because it's their argument.
I think it would absolutely make it virtually... A public university would be at such a gross disadvantage to a private one that you wouldn't have anybody who wanted to be a professor at that university.
I find that argument without foundation in fact.
I'm saying that if you said that everything they ever wrote was immediately subject to FOIA, you'd have to agree with it.
Well, I believe that the intent of the legislature was fairly clear. The intent of the legislature was, in fact, to protect the data, the records, and the information coming out of investigation that the university sponsored. And it ought to be. However, once it's published, then it all must be available. And so there is a valid legislative intent here. Now,
are you saying that an email is that's a publishing act?
No. What I'm saying is that when the research is completed and the university and the professor publish their research articles, at that point in time, when they research the findings of their effort, then all of the information that went into that should be made public.
Well, that's perhaps a reasonable response, but it's certainly not the literal statement in the statute, which makes very little sense to me. But go ahead with your argument.
I would suggest that the legislature made it clear what it had intended. And admittedly, there's very little legislative history in Virginia. But in this case, if you look at what Senator Michie intended when he first drafted it, he had a narrow exclusion, dealt only with research data. It went to committee. The committee expanded it to cover anything associated with research. The Senate passed that, sent it to the House of Delegates. The House of Delegates said no. Return to the Michie language, making some changes, but narrowing it again. And so the legislature clearly intended that there be this narrow band of data for a narrow period of time that should be protected. And that's the problem here, is that the majority of these documents don't contain data, or records, or information coming from the research. That's just, they simply don't.
All right, well, I've distracted you from your main argument. Would you go ahead and talk about the definition of proprietary?
Well, proprietary, has to do with an interest at issue. In Green v. Lewis, Pastor Green had a proprietary interest in the exclusivity. He got to say who got to use the church. When you ask what is the university's proprietary interest, it is not that we own the emails or the data. It is that they want to use it in a marketplace of ideas to the exclusion of others who might take it and run with the ball first. And so when you look at that exclusion, then the proper term means a competitive advantage in the marketplace of ideas and in some cases in an economic marketplace. That is what the legislature appears to have intended by the use of their words. Now, there are other issues before you. I want to raise the one issue that government may not charge for review. As this court has pointed out as recently as this morning, you cannot write out of a statute language that is in it. And in the section 3704, it specifically prohibits charging for records maintenance and maintaining records and transacting the general business of the public policy. Every government employee, whether it's a county employee teaching in a school, a personnel office, or a university professor, when asked for a public record, must ask themselves, is this subject to release or am I prohibited from releasing it? This duty rises under the Virginia Public Records Act, not FOIA, and it is a duty that is part of maintaining records. If one says that supplying records includes reviewing records, you've written out of the statute the prohibition for charging for maintaining records. And it is an issue that applies across the government, not purely with the university. It's an important issue, and we believe one that needs to be addressed directly. I want to last touch on the potential chilling effect. The Freedom of Information Act offers a deliberative process privilege. And it's this deliberative process that people are concerned about protecting. However, the Virginia legislature excluded professors. In fact, only one person at the University of Virginia has the right to be protected under the deliberative process privilege, and it's the university president. And it's not on research, it's only on how she manages the university. Furthermore, as I explained in the legislative process before, they excluded, by action of the House returning a bill to the Senate that was much narrower, this deliberative work. And although some of it, I agree, we might like to see protected, neither I nor you have the freedom to write that law. The legislator wrote it. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Just for you, I'm going to give each side 5 additional minutes, so if you want to go on a little bit more, you'll have some additional time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd also like to deal with the chilling effect with regard to actual experience and the evidence before the court. There's no actual evidence that anyone has stopped using an email system. Indeed, when Jared Mason University was asked for the identical kind of emails on the exact same topic, the professor there said, I'm not going to give them to you until I finish the paper. When he finished, they renewed their request, and within 5 days, at no cost, in electronic form, they produced all of the emails. He had no concern about a chilling effect. He's still there. He's still using his email system. And so, too, are the professors and the other academics whose emails we sought in this, even though there was a massive release of their emails from East Anglia University, something called ClimateGate. There's been no change in the use of their email systems, and that's true for public as well as private institutions. That's true whether it's a federal government or the state government. So when it comes to the concern about this, we think that there is an area, and we've said in brief, an area that is not yet protected by the exemption that perhaps should be, the research planning process. But in general, the deliberative debate is not protected. It was not the intent of the legislature to do so. Finally, I'd like to just say that we have identified in brief many examples of how these emails don't meet all 7 of the requirements. For example, an unsolicited email that came into the university was not collected by or for the university for research. It's no different than an email from a citizen to a county supervisor who's angry and wants something done. And as such, that kind of thing cannot be held, much less under a research data exclusion. And many of the emails deal with not research, but a service activity that was never sponsored by the university. And it's all 7 of these that must be made therefore you can withhold them. We submit not one of the 22 does. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice and Justice.
Excuse me, they'll get 20 minutes instead of 15.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice and Justices of the Court. My name is Richard Cast. I'm here today representing the appellee of the University of Virginia. My colleague, Madeline Wessel, also will be participating in this argument, and I will reserve for her an appropriate period of time to do that. She will be addressing essentially the elements of the argument that concern intellectual property rights, Section D, actually, of our brief.
Could I ask you a question before we start? To follow up on Justice Lemon's question to opposing counsel about copyright and more specifically the emails. It seems to me that some emails just say, attach, find this data, and I don't think that would be a creative work. But some emails may have the thoughts of the author in there. Are those creative works that are, in fact, copyright material?
Your Honor, I would defer to Madeline for a more substantial response, but my understanding is that original thoughts of that nature are copyrightable, and the creator of those works, those thoughts, has a copyright interest, whether it is registered or not. Now, I think what the statute must be dealing with when it talks about copyright, in that clause that talks about publication, copyright, patent, etc., is a formal copyright registration.
A registration, even though it doesn't say that.
It makes no sense.
Okay.
I mean, it's the exception that eats the rule.
And that's why you all agreed that they were copyright material, but you did not take exception to the court's finding that they weren't.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
I will be dealing with the other aspects of... Yes, sir.
Parties can concede facts. They can't concede law. Nonetheless, I'm interested whether your opposing counsel also would agree that copyright in the statute is intended to or obviously means something that where a copyright has been registered. Or do the two of you disagree on that particular interpretation?
Your Honor, to my knowledge, there was no formal discussion between counsel on that issue.
Okay.
So that is our position. I'm not sure whether it is opposing counsel's position. First of all, I'd like to address the we have argued alternatively, as the Court is aware, and I think accurately, that what is at issue here in this proprietary nature, and I would emphasize that the statute talks about of a proprietary nature, which I think is a little bit different than proprietary in the sense that it is used in that 25 different subsections of 3705.6, which does talk very definitely about competitive advantage. We say competitive advantage is not necessary here. But at the same time, and Madeline will be fleshing this out more succinctly and thoroughly, that competitive advantage is very much an element and a concern to the university. But just dealing initially with the point that ATI makes very strongly, that competitive advantage is a necessary element of this particular convention, 3705.4 subsection 4, which I will refer to as the academic exclusion, it simply isn't true. It's not in there. It doesn't say that anywhere. So we say that, number one, the first thing obviously that a court looks at in interpreting the statute is what does the statute say and what does it not say. And what it says here is of a proprietary nature. Data, records, and information of proprietary nature, that's what sets the table for the rest of the prerequisites of that particular statutory exemption. Nowhere does it say competitive advantage is a necessary prerequisite to invoking that particular exclusion.
Well, nowhere does it say that ownership does either, but that was the trial court's decision. So you have to define it somehow. It's not defined.
It is not defined, and we thought and continue to argue, obviously, that this court's decision in Green versus Lewis, in which this court noted a right customarily associated with ownership, title, and possession, is proprietary. And then went on importantly to qualify that by saying, does not necessarily depend upon a monetary investment We think that's what proprietary means in the context of this particular exclusion. Now,
but wouldn't the practical effect of that be that nothing would be disposed of?
I don't believe that's true.
If you own it, and that's the definition of it, why wouldn't that be the end of the story?
Because of the additional elements of that particular academic exclusion, because there are a number of them. And in fact, it's interesting because in this case, the university did in fact disclose quite a large number of documents in response to this specific Freedom of Information Act request. We by no means took the position that everything that they were asking for was exempt. And
well, that, I mean, was that an act of grace? We're talking about a question of law. You have a case again. We have thousands of cases that we're looking at that might be applicable. So is ownership, is that that's the issue? But you gave them other things because it was an act of grace?
No, Your Honor. It's not just ownership. It is, and the best thing probably is just to look at the language of the statute. Data, records, or information of a proprietary nature produced or collected by or for faculty or staff of public institutions of higher education, other than the institution's financial or administrative records, in the conduct of or as a result of study or research on medical, scientific, technical, or scholarly issues, whether sponsored by the institution alone, or in conjunction with a governmental body or a private concern where such data, records, or information has not been publicly released, published, copyrighted, or patented. So there a number of requirements there, and the proprietary nature issue, the ownership, the ability to assert dominion and control over something because it is of a proprietary nature, is limited by all of the rest of it.
Counsel, and I want to talk about we do have no definition of proprietary. It's limited by the very specific language that you read. Is not our interpretation, though, also limited by the preamble to FOIA in 3700? It says the provision shall be liberally construed to promote increased awareness by all personal government activities and by a specific rule of interpretation that comes later that says that any exemption from public access shall be narrowly construed. So if we face, without a definition in the statute, we face a plausible definition from the university and a plausible definition from ATI, and they appear to be equally plausible, are we not constrained by both the preamble and the specific interpretation directive we're given to choose the narrow interpretation over the broad interpretation?
Your Honor, that may be the case if you were faced with two plausible interpretations. It's certainly our argument that you're not. That ATI's interpretation actually flies in the face of the plain language of the statute. It further flies in the face of the legislative history. It's interesting that they have made much of the legislative history because the legislative history clearly indicates that Senator Mickey's bill originally would have supported their position that competitive advantage was an element of what Senator Mickey envisioned as part of that particular exclusion. And that ended up being taken out, and the language that's now in this exclusion is what is in the law. And the other thing is, and I will defer to Madeline on this, but the substantial public policy that underlies this emanates not just from the First Amendment and academic freedom of the institution and of the University of Virginia and its faculty, but also from long-established protocols for scientific research and scholarship, copyright interests and how they may be asserted and who owns them and how they are created, all kinds of issues like that that I think the General Assembly was grappling with when they, to their credit, and not every state by any means has an exclusion like this, when they to their credit, enacted the exclusion. And the other thing you have to keep in mind when you think about the broad legislative directive that is contained within the Freedom of Information Act, that it is supposed to be about, obviously, openness and disclosure, is that there are 127 exclusions, all of which are animated by some aspect of public policy. And this court in the Taylor versus Worrell case, which we quote in our brief, recognized that it's a balancing act between disclosure mandated by public policy and those aspects of that disclosure mandate that have to be modified in various specific ways to also advance the public interest. And the public interest is very much at issue. We're talking about a public university, and the aspect of Madeline's argument that I will defer to her on substantially, but that is very important, is that, yeah, there is a competitive disadvantage issue here. As I think it was Justice Lemons alluded to earlier, the University of Virginia is going to be at a distinct disadvantage if its scientists and its researchers and its scholars cannot communicate with some expectation of privacy and confidentiality with respect to their colleagues at private institutions. And many of the University of Virginia's peer institutions with whom our faculty actively collaborate are private institutions.
But wouldn't that be preserved if we took a more narrow view of what proprietary nature means, and that in and of itself also means that there be some intellectual or competitive advantage that has to come into play in the definition of proprietary? Won't they still get the protection that's obviously needed and justified?
I think, first of all, that wouldn't be consistent with the language of the exclusion. But secondly, I don't think it would protect it. Because in every instance in which we had an extraordinarily broad request, such as this one, seeking all of the emails that had been generated by one of our faculty members over a period of years, in order to be able to invoke the exclusion, if that were the interpretation that had to be applied, we would have to be able to demonstrate, if challenged, that each and every one of those communications would somehow erode the competitive advantage of the University of Virginia.
But under your definition, but I know there are a lot of limiting factors in the exception, and that you have to meet each one of them before the exclusion is invoked and applicable. But just dealing with the one phrase that is the subject of your assignment of error about proprietary nature, under your definition and the trial court's definition, it seems to me that at least you would start out with every email, and then you would obviously eliminate as you applied the other factors. But that one phrase would encompass every email of a particular professor.
And that is exactly the process that we went through that resulted in the disclosure of a vast number of documents, such a large number of documents that, ironically, ATI took the position in the trial court and assigned error to the fact that the trial court did not find that they had substantially prevailed because of the number of documents that they had received pursuant to the two disclosures that we made in May and August of 2005.
Mr. Kasten, I'd like to ask you one question in response to your opposing counsel, and that is that once the research or publication on a particular issue occurs, that at that point a FOIA request for the materials such as we have here should not be denied. That when it's done, there is no more competitive advantage or competitive interest in the documents leading up to the published report.
That is another reason, I think, why the competitive advantage requirement, although it is relevant, should not be the sole criteria, because it may result in that interpretation, which I think is wrong and antithetical to and destructive to the whole process of scientific research and scholarship, which we have set forth in numerous affidavits that are in the appendix. And unless there are further questions,
that's a pretty broad statement. I don't understand why you're applying it to after publication versus pre-publication.
After publication, And it's clear in the record, two things are clear in the record, one of which it's not clear that any of the information that ATI is seeking is published. And the other thing that is clear is that to the extent that Dr. Mann did, in fact, publish in scholarly journals, peer-reviewed journals, all of the data and all of the research that was applicable to and generated that particular article was made available. And there's been no contest about that either.
Okay.
And with that, I would like to allow the remaining portion of the argument to go to my co-counsel, Madeline.
All right. Thank you.
Please, the court. My name is Madeline Wessel, and it's an honor to be here with you today. I think many of your questions have been profound and interesting, and many of them go to what does the statutory language specifically say. So getting, as a follow-up to your recent question, Justice, the issue here is the text, we think, of the statute says, asks whether the records, data, or information have themselves been published or copyrighted or patented or publicly disclosed. So the fact that a scientist may engage over decades in grant-funded research and scholarly activity and build a body of data and information that they work on and through for many years doesn't mean that it's even possible, necessarily, to say that when a single paper comes out and scientists publish dozens, if not hundreds, of papers, that that corpus of information has already been disclosed. In fact, quite to the contrary, that would not typically be the case. I think a very elegant way for the court to experience and see from an evidentiary level how this process works would be to read the affidavit of Provost John Simon, which is part of the record in this case, and several of the other scientists who gave affidavit evidence in this case, the only affidavit evidence in this case really describing what science does and is. And it eloquently speaks to the fact that a researcher can be involved in a line of research for a long period of time and not always recognize the complete implications of that work, may come after new and additional work to understand that data that was discarded or considered unimportant and not referenced and not disclosed in a particular paper is actually really important and is now worthy of a new publication or a new grant or research proposal. So the idea that it would even be possible to segment out, to disaggregate, and to say, well, a paper was published on XYZ, therefore every communication between scientific colleagues over a period of 10 years is now subject to disclosure, simply doesn't work. And the record evidence in this case, I think, powerfully does bring that point home.
That while that make perfect sense, and while I may personally agree with everything you just said, we have a statute to interpret.
Absolutely, Justice. And the statute says, the statute asks whether that data, that information, or those records have themselves been publicly disclosed, copyrighted. I think that does speak to the issue of copyright registration, which requires deposit with the Library of Congress of the entirety of the work that is being formally registered. And that is a public disclosure at that point. Or patented, which also involves disclosure and very intimate descriptions for the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office of the full content of the work. So the point here is not that individual publications may not get out in the world. They do. And actually, another point to be made here is that we would agree with appellants in this on one point at least, which is that norms of science increasingly require that when a scientist publishes a paper on a particular subject that describes research data, journals are increasingly requiring, and scholarly and scientific societies are expecting, that the data is also deposited along with the article and is subject to peer review, reproducibility, and accountability as a result. As my colleague, Mr. Cass, pointed out, and as the record unequivocally represents, all of the data that has been published about, has been described publicly by Dr. Mann, he has actually made that data available on his own scientific website. So there is nothing in the record to suggest that the data that was the subject of actual publications has been withheld or that either Dr. Mann or the university has any wish to hide it. Now, the court has asked some very important and at times critical questions about the interpretation of proprietary nature and just what is required by that term. Our position is that whether the term is interpreted correctly, we think, by Judge Sheridan as having a fairly narrow meaning, a possessory interest, or whether this court elects to characterize and view it as requiring competitive harm, proprietary damage, those kinds of concepts, which appellants argue.
First of all, let me suggest to you, I don't think that's narrow. I think it's huge. The definition of proprietary, a thing or property owned or in the possession of one who manages and controls them. That's huge. That's not narrow.
Okay, I'll reverse course. If you think it's appropriate to, in fact, construe the term more narrowly than Judge Sheridan did, we think that the record evidence here abundantly and powerfully proves that the University of Virginia, its scientists, and the broader scientific community, because this is a very important case, not only within the Commonwealth but elsewhere, would suffer demonstrable, factually supported proprietary harm, and that the university and other institutions in the Commonwealth would suffer tremendous competitive disadvantages. And you have a whole series of affidavits, some from our own faculty, some from people like Provost John Simon, who has been at both Duke, a great private university, and has now come to UVA, which really substantiate that. You also have statements from people.
Can I help you along with this? Because, I agree with you, everything you just said. I cannot imagine that the legislature of Virginia intended a public university to be at a competitive disadvantage with a private one within the borders of the Commonwealth of Virginia. There are so many collateral consequences of that, I just cannot attribute to the General Assembly that intent. And I think in many respects that would happen if this is the definition. So what I'm saying is I see this definition. I don't think it's very narrow. I think it ought to be narrow. So I ask you, what should it be?
I think that with all due respect that the university and Dr. Mann have proved that the trial court decision was correct, whether the interpretation is broad or narrow. And the reason for that is that the entirety of the record evidence shows that there would be immense damage to the university and to its scientists and scholars were there not the protections afforded, we think, by the plain language of the statute for a narrow subset of information. It is not the case, and my colleague, Mr. Cast, has pointed out, that the university takes the position that it will not disclose records or that it will not disclose records of its faculty. The issue is whether the records are data or information that relate to scholarly or scientific research specifically.
Before your time has expired, but there's one question I've been saving, if you don't mind. There's a document in the university's lexicon of matters that have to do with this entitled Ownership Rights in Copyrightable Material. Right? So this is copyrightable material. There's no question about that. In that document, it cedes the ownership to the author, which who in this case is Dr. Mann. And so my question is, if that's the case, what standing does the university have to assert his rights?
Wonderful question. If you read that particular policy carefully, you see that the university asserts and retains some very important rights, even to copyrightable expression that is ceded back to our faculty. First of all, the university retains essentially a shop right to continue to use that intellectual property for the university's purposes. The university also imposes some limitations on that restoration when significant university resources have been invested in the production of that copyrightable expression, and the university could realize royalties or other compensation from it. But the other point to be made here is that that grant back is actually limited for our faculty to articles and scholarly books. That's how a faculty member can sign a contract with a publisher, as we pointed out in our brief. But it wouldn't necessarily apply in full to the very substantive, as the court will have seen from the exemplars, deep, detailed scholarly and scientific debates and conversations about research that are contained in the email correspondence. We think the best way to characterize ownership there is it's really a joint ownership, an ownership between the faculty member and the university, because this is the nascent corpus of IP that goes into then productive published scholarship.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Madam. I'd like to correct a couple of quick questions of fact. First of all, Dr. Mann did not write all of these emails. The vast majority of the emails, in fact, he received or he was a courtesy copy on, which raised the question I don't wish to discuss at any length, and which is, if you're a courtesy copy recipient, has that been made public because it was sent to someone else and then sent to you? We provided a citation on that. Secondly, the argument that all the data that upon which Dr. Mann relied has been made public is simply not true, and we have in the joint appendix a lengthy set of emails showing that he did not and could not reproduce his data. And one of the problems we found is we asked the university for his research logs. All professors are required to keep their research data for 5 years. He never kept a log. But he is not alone. 14 of the 15 professors had no research log of any kind at all. It is apparently a policy without teeth. The other point is there's an email in the joint appendix where a professor, I believe from South Africa, I don't recall where exactly, asked for the exact model and computer code Professor Mann used because she wanted to build off what he did. She wanted to replicate exactly what he did. And he could not produce it. He couldn't produce it because he never kept it. He kept just changing his computer code without reserve, without keeping version 1, version 2, version 3. And this is precisely the problem that arises when someone wishes to replicate the data. If the body of data that supports a research publication is not available, then you cannot replicate the work. And part of the purpose of asking for this is because of the failure to keep some of the original data, and there are hopes that some of these emails will provide insight into what assumptions were used and how this work was done. It's extremely important to understand, and I'm going to quote President Eisenhower in his January 17, 1961 farewell speech. Three of you have heard this already. I'm going to share it with you again because it makes the point as to the power of the Freedom of Information Act. He said, "Yet in holding scientific research and discovery in respect, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific technological elite." We've pointed out in our records, in the joint appendix, in our argument, examples of papers that were published where someone else who was a colleague wrote an email and said, "Your paper's bunk," and explained why, and cited why. But the paper was never pulled, and had been cited to over 200 times. And the only way the public found out about it was because we had access to that professor's emails, which we sought, and which allowed people to understand that here was a piece of work that did not justify and could not support major policy issues that come forward. And one of the things Judge Sheridan made clear on the stand was that there is no question there continues to be concern about the basis for one of the largest public policy issues we confront today, and that is how to deal with climate change. And if we cannot get to the core science, we cannot get to the data, and we cannot validate it, then we have a secret kind of data that is precisely the problem President Eisenhower pointed to. Additionally, it's important to note that...
Counsel,
yes, sir.
Before you get to additionally, now that you've indicated what you wanted to correct, I have the same question for you that I had for Mr. Tass. Parties can concede facts to us.
Right.
They cannot concede law to us.
Right.
I am, though, quite curious whether your interpretation of the term copyrighted in the context of the statute is the same as the university's, which is that when the term copyrighted is used, it is referring to that those documents that are in fact copyrightable and which where an additional step has been taken and they have in fact been registered.
We argued that point, and I did not agree with that. I think they misrepresented my position.
No, he didn't say it was your position. I want to know what is your position with
my position is very straightforward. Copyright meant that you've registered it and it has a copyright symbol on it, and you can go to court and protect it on the basis of what's already been filed. That is the plain meaning of the term copyright. It didn't say subject to copyright. It said copyright.
Oh, but I believe I heard him say the same thing just now. When we look at the word copyright in the statute,
right.
If we were to interpret that to say those documents which are subject to copyright and have been registered with the Copyright Office. Mm-hmm. That is your definition as well? That is how you believe the term is used in the statute?
You cannot get a copyright unless it's subject to copyright. And therefore, I think it's only necessary to say that it has been copyrighted. In other words, it has been registered with the copyright office. And the point here is that anything has already been made public. So it's an example of something that's been made public. It's important to keep in mind that there is no expectation of privacy in email. That is the university's policy, that is the Commonwealth's policy, and the notion that somehow one can keep secret what's in emails is without foundation. I see my time has expired. I thank the court for your attention.
Thank you. The court is adjourned until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All rise.